Will March come in like a lion or a lamb? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, February 24th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we check the drought outlook with state climatologist Laura Edwards. In their own words, explores efforts to revise parole eligibility for people sentenced to life in prison. The Dakota Political Junkies examine the political future of South Dakota Attorney General Jason Roundsburg. The governor calls for his resignation and lawmakers proceed with impeachment. John Hunter and John Schaff are with us. Then Rick Kaler helps you do that thing you dread to do, file your taxes. We'll talk about the emotions of tax time. Plus, Laura Rohde explores how the tiniest of problems might not be as problematic as we think. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Police interrogation videos reveal new details about a fatal vehicle pedestrian accident involving Attorney General Jason Roundsburg. Governor Kristi Noem has asked Roundsburg to resign, and the Attorney General faces impeachment articles in the legislature. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
The State Department of Public Safety released the videos that show investigators interrogating Roundsburg twice for a total of about 3 hours. Investigators from North Dakota conducted the interviews. Last September, Roundsburg was driving home at night from a political event when his car struck and killed Joe Beaver. Beaver was walking on the shoulder of a highway near Highmore. Throughout the interviews, Roundsburg maintained he did not know what he hit until he returned to the scene the next morning and found the body. He says he assumed he had hit a deer. The investigators told Roundsburg that Beaver's face went through the windshield. They said Beaver's glasses were found inside Roundsburg's car.
We know that his face came through your windshield. We know that. We already talked about that. That's, I would think, substantially clear that that's what happened. We also have the imprint on the hood where his body, well, at least part of his body, likely was riding. At some point in time, he rolls off, takes out the mirror, and slides into the ditch. I want you to be really honest right now. I never saw him.
Investigators told Roundsburg that Beaver's body was lying only a couple of feet from the edge of the road. A flashlight Beaver carried was still on, even when investigators found it later, they said. Roundsburg repeated many times that he never saw the body that night. Roundsburg also denied being distracted by his smartphone. But the investigators showed him data indicating he was on his phone, looking at news articles and blog posts until about a minute before the crash.
So when we look at that, our concern is everything that we're seeing here is appearing that you were on your phone reading political stuff at the time.
But I just wasn't. I set it down.
A spokesman for Roundsburg said the Attorney General does not intend to resign. Roundsburg is charged with 3 misdemeanors: careless driving, driving out of his lane, and operating a motor vehicle while on his phone. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper.
A House committee is passing a bill that seeks to close the gap when a missing Indigenous person is taken off the reservation. The tribes and FBI are aware of the missing person, but the state can be out of the loop. Democratic Representative Perry Poirier is Oglala Lakota. She wants to close that gap. The bill establishes the Office of Liaison for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons in the Attorney General's office. That office would coordinate with the many governmental jurisdictions that exist in South Dakota.
When a child or a woman or any missing person crosses off of the reservation, we have a seamless operation, which happens in sometimes other crimes, like fugitives. But when it comes to missing and murdered Indigenous women and children, it's unseen and it's unheard.
Last year, former President Donald Trump signed 2 bills aimed at addressing missing and murdered Indigenous women and children, Savannah's Act and Not Invisible Act. Poirier says there are currently 77 missing Indigenous people from reservations located within South Dakota's state borders. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Let's welcome Laura Edwards to the program now. She's South Dakota State climatologist, and she's joining us for a look at the spring climate outlook, particularly as we anticipate possible drought conditions in the state. Welcome, Laura Edwards. Thanks for being here.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we think about snow in March and rain in April and May, and we're also worried about drought. So give us an overview of what we can expect in the weeks ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, starting off with where we're at now, as of last week, we have about 87% of the state in some level of drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, and very little snowpack out there now, as we've had some very warm temperatures this week. And as we look forward into the next couple weeks to start with, looks like continued warm and dry conditions. Overall, March and the month ahead looks a little uncertain if we'll hold that pattern in. But later spring, April, May, June, and the summer season does look like we're leaning towards warmer than average conditions in general in the spring and summer. That in combination with more likely drier than average in the south to start with, and then out in the west as we look ahead in the midsummer, kind of makes a recipe for continued concerns about drought and maybe getting worse, actually, as we look towards the next 3 to 5 months or so.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, the state of the ground. When we talk about snow melt, is it able to sink in if there's more snow in March? What are the frozen conditions like?
Yeah, and soils is a big piece of the puzzle here as in our cold season, in our winter season. Starting with the fall season, you know, we had very dry fall, very mild weather or climate since then. And so kind of what happens in the fall locks in over the winter season as the soils freeze and they can't really take up a lot more moisture if we get rain or snow melt. So we're going into the spring season with pretty dry soils. And I know last year was very wet this time in the soil moisture profile. Today we have about half the amount of soil moisture as we did about a year ago. You know, with the soils as dry as they are, you know, it takes a lot more moisture now to refill, say, the stock dams for livestock water, and we need a lot more rain to moisten up the soil before we can get to water coming up on the surface to fill the stock dams and creeks and rivers and all those other things.
What's your recommendation for farmers and ranchers now who are looking ahead? Are they seeing signs of what things might be like in their acres now?
Yeah, and I have seen that and heard that from my colleagues at SDSU Extension, too, where people have had to bring out supplemental feed because they were short on feed last year even, and this is true particularly out west in the central part of the state. So hoping that we can get really some good rains this spring to help grasses, pastures, and our crops grow really well. And I think there is a fair bit of concern out there. You know, now is the time, though, to be planning ahead. Think about what are those dates that maybe are trigger dates to make some decisions out on the farm and ranch. And even, you know, a lot of us with yards and gardens and trees may need to water more than usual, at least to start off the spring season.
Laura Edwards is the state climatologist. Thanks so much, Laura. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
We've put a link up to her climate outlet on our website, SDPB, her climate outlook, I should say, on our website, sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Later in the hour, we talk about how the stress of tax time can bring up those beliefs about money and how they all can show up in surprising ways when you're sorting through those receipts. But first, today's In Their Own Words takes you inside the Senate Judiciary Committee. Members heard testimony on Senate Bill 146, It's legislation seeking to revise certain provisions regarding eligibility for parole for people sentenced to life in prison.
Under consideration, Senate Bill 146, an act to revise certain provisions regarding eligibility for parole for certain persons sentenced to life in prison. And we're going to start with proponent testimony by the prime sponsor, Senator Rush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I remove my mask?
Yes, you may.
So this is a bill that I prepared. You know, last year I prepared a bill that dealt with parole eligibility of people convicted of second-degree murder and manslaughter, and it didn't get very far before this. But, you know, really since then studied and the issues and what some other states are doing, some of the research that's been done on the effect of being young and the kind of stupid decisions you make when you're young. And I've talked to a lot of people, legislators and citizens, since then about whether they made any stupid decisions when they were young, and most of them refused to answer. In doing this bill, what did a couple of things. Number one, for special treatment of young people who had been convicted of a crime when they were under 25 years of age, because that seems to be the cutoff line between which when they can say that they really, the brain has matured and when it's not. It does something secondly, which is, I think, of major importance, and that it sets a time period of 25 years, minimum of 25 years, at which we can look back and see whether they've really turned their lives around and are rehabilitated or not. You know, if they were 25 at the time when they committed the crime, then it would be 25. If they were 19, it could be up to 31 years before the parole board would look at it. It's not a jail get out of jail free card either. It's only be released if the parole board decides that they've been rehabilitated and that they're no longer dangerous. So let me go back. You know, in my 18 years on the bench, I sentenced thousands and thousands of people. And sentencing is a difficult thing to do. And I spent last weekend reading some of the United States Supreme Court and South Dakota Supreme Court decisions on sentencing. But there are quite a few decisions about sentencing here in South Dakota. And in fact, on some of those, the Supreme Court has reversed sentences that were imposed because the proper factors were not taken into consideration. And, you know, I think there's some real clear messages that are sent out by those Supreme Court decisions. First of all, the goals of sentencing are retribution, deterrence, both individual and general, rehabilitation, and incapacitation. But the Supreme Court also says that no one purpose is preeminent over all of the others. In other words, retribution is not preeminent over rehabilitation, and rehabilitation is not preeminent over retribution. Further, they went on to point out that a life sentence without parole deters the convict or defendant from committing crime and exacts retribution. But a life sentence completely eschews the goal of rehabilitation. So anytime there's a life sentence, that the court has abandoned rehabilitation as one of the goals of that sentence. The Supreme Court in some of their cases has further pointed out that a term of years allows for rehabilitation and allows a defendant hope. And in talking with some of the people that I know in corrections, you know, having a defendant or a prisoner who has hope that they might eventually be able to earn their release is a tremendous thing as far as motivating them to good behavior in the prison. Because if they don't have any hope, then why behave? So I think that it's essential that we provide a tool or legal procedure where that evaluation and comparison can be done. And the difficulty with our existing laws right now is that the court can do that for a period of 1 year, 23A 27 4.1. says that the judge can reevaluate and resentence somebody within 1 year of the time they're sentenced. Well, how can the court make a decision about whether the person is truly rehabilitated within 1 year? That there just isn't enough opportunity. There just isn't enough time for the court to make that kind of an evaluation. Only the passage of time will show whether the defendant is really amenable to rehabilitation. And at 1 year, we don't really have a good means of evaluating the defendant. So this bill of mine is a dramatic change from that. It gives a minimum of 25 years to look and see whether that person is amenable to rehabilitation. And it gives that power to make that decision to the Board of Pardons and Paroles. So, I would ask you to vote in favor of this bill and establish a procedure, anyway, to follow what the Supreme Court has said, that that there needs to be an evaluation. Now, some people probably would tell you that 25 years is too long, but like I say, that should give a real good picture about whether they've been rehabilitated or not. So, thank you.
Committee questions? If none, then we'll move to opponent testimony in the committee room. Welcome, Mr. Attorney General.
Members of the committee, Jason Ronsberg, Attorney General, South Dakota. So we took an honest look at this. Our numbers showed that, and we're working with the parole Department of Corrections, we had 73 that we found that were eligible. Out of those 73, 33 were convicted of first-degree murder, 20 for second-degree murder, 11 for man one, and 9 had other categories, and those other categories are a combination of that, of murder, manslaughter, or some kind of kidnapping, rape combination. I don't want to minimize it since they're in an other category that they were any less. Out of those 73, then, 44 would be eligible under this bill. 24 of those would be for murder one. So 24 out of the 44 would be for murder one. Only 7 for second-degree murder, 8 for man one, and in 5 in another category. I would disagree that all of the people would wait 25 years. How the bill is written, it says when they committed the offense. For example, we have John Graham. John Graham was not convicted until he was 56 years old. And so he committed his crime prior to 25, and he would have been immediately eligible for parole under this bill. I don't think anybody would argue that he'd obviously learned from it at that point. A number of them that you will find are also in their 30s, so it's not necessarily a 25-year period. It sometimes takes a while to catch the person and obviously go through the court process to get a conviction. Some of them have been granted parole already. I would give you an example of Rocky Blair. Rocky was released from parole, and he abducted a victim in a hospital parking lot and raped and killed her within an hour. He's one convicted of man one. So again, just because it's not murder one or murder two doesn't mean his crime wasn't horrible. Man one and also rape one. These, along with many other examples, show why I cannot support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Any other opponent testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Aaron Scheibe on behalf of the South Dakota State Attorneys Association. I would urge you to oppose Senate Bill 146. As you can expect, the state's attorneys are at the forefront of prosecuting cases that are implicated in this change to law. I would submit to you that there's already a number of processes in place that adequately address the concerns that are raised for these offenders under the age of 25. But I think the one thing that maybe hasn't been discussed today that I do want to highlight is that there is, I think, an interest on the part of society, on the part of victims, and a part of victims' families, that there be appropriate sentencing in these types of cases. In many cases, in particular, obviously the murder cases, the victims are not there to speak up for themselves in this process. And I think that that's something that should weigh on all of our consciences. Now, Senator Rush, in his testimony, did, I think, a great job in highlighting and really painting the picture for the committee about all of the process and procedures and safeguards that are already in place through Supreme Court precedent, both at the federal level as well as at the state level. to ensure great latitude in sentencing in these cases. There are a number of avenues that are available at a variety of different junctures to address cases in which an individual committed an offense below the age of 25 and then later on demonstrates either rehabilitation or a changed circumstance. In our view, we shouldn't create a class of murderers who are eligible for parole. A life sentence should be a life sentence once it's imposed. So in conclusion, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for those reasons, I would urge you to oppose this change. It's an unnecessary change in our view at this point and does not appropriately respect the process and procedures that are already in place. Thank you.
Senate Bill 146 passed in the Judiciary Committee. It was amended on the Senate floor, and it was approved by the Senate on a vote of 18 to 17. Well, the measure now moves on to the House, and you can hear the entire committee meeting at SD.net. Follow the South Dakota Legislature link in the meeting archives section. Up next, a man was killed and his family and community mourn, but it's also hard to escape the political drama surrounding South Dakota's Attorney General, who was the driver of the car that struck and killed Joe Beaver. The Dakota Political Junkies explain the latest coming up on In the Moment. You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota Attorney General Jason Roundsburg is refusing to step down even after Governor Kristi Noem has called for him to resign, and articles of impeachment have been filed in the South Dakota State Legislature with support of both Republicans and Democrats. Meanwhile, videos of Roundsburg's investigation into the accident that killed pedestrian Joe Beaver have been released by the state. For today's Dakota Political Junkies Insight, we welcome John Schaaf. He's professor of political science at Northern State University, and he's joining us from the Tom and Danielle Amon studio on the campus of NSU in Aberdeen. Professor Schaaf, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. Good to be with you.
A lot has happened since the last time we talked with this case. After weeks and weeks of waiting, we know what he's being charged with, just three misdemeanors, which some people find inadequate. But Governor Noem almost immediately called for the Attorney General's resignation. And lawmakers are saying he's lost the faith and trust of South Dakotans. Let's talk a little bit about the release of the records and the video interviews of with North Dakota investigators talking with Jason Roundsburg. How unusual and how significant politically is it that the governor released so much information about the investigation?
Well, I think what people need to be maybe cognizant of is making a distinction between there's a legal case, and just as you just described it, Lori, there's a legal case and there's a political case going on. Mm-hmm. And the legal case, without trying to be credulous and naive, let's just assume that the state's attorney made the right decision, that whatever went on, the evidence indicated as it aligned with South Dakota law, maybe these misdemeanor charges, these lower charges were all that she thought that she could reasonably convict on, and that anything higher than that wasn't really feasible given the evidence and the way the law is written. And that itself might be a separate question as to whether our law on vehicular homicides is inadequate. But then there's a political question as well, is that it is clear, I think you could probably sort of suss this out, maybe not from the beginning, but close to the beginning, that Kristi Noem was, if you will, disquieted by the events involved here and has not really been all that supportive of Jason Roundsburg. And this is just the latest piece of evidence that, as you said, she called for his resignation shortly after the charges were filed. And the release of these videos of the investigators seems to be a way of sort of adding information to the public to lead the conclusion that the governor and some members of the legislature appear to have already come to, which is that whatever the legal complications of the case, politically, Jason Roundsburg can't really continue as Attorney General of the United States. And this is just, you know, the administration giving the public more information, I think, to reach the decision that, that they've made.
Yeah. Attorney General of South Dakota, you misspoke what, there and said.
What did I
Attorney
say?
General, you said of the U.S., so.
Oh, sorry.
Clearly you know, but for listeners who don't, he is the Attorney General of the state of South Dakota, and that was the Hyde County State's Attorney who brought the charges and made the final decision on those charges. But yeah, we're talking about that political fallout right now, and it really means something as well that impeachment articles have been brought. That seems like a surprise. It hasn't happened before in South Dakota. The lawmakers are also, I have not, John, heard anyone who spoke out, who has spoken out in an official statement anyway, in support of Jason Raunsberg keeping his job. Have you?
No, not in, no one in official positions, no. And so I think this is why what we mean is that whatever the legal situation Jason Raunsberg is in is, however you cut this, right, there is a man who is dead because of some level of negligence of Jason Raunsberg. And I think some of the information that we get out of the interviews that were released yesterday, and I'm going on news accounts of those. I haven't watched the videos myself. I'm going on the news accounts of the videos. What it tells me is that one of three things has to be true. Either Jason Raunsberg is not telling the truth when he says he doesn't know what, or more accurately, we now know who he hit, or when he says he wasn't really distracted. That seems, you know, either he knew what he hit or he was really distracted, more so than he lets on. In either of those two cases, he doesn't seem to be very forthcoming. Or the only third alternative is that Jason Raunsberg was an unusually inattentive driver. It's hard for me, given the information of the case, to conclude, unless he was distracted in some way, shape, or form, in a way that he is not letting on that he was distracted, it's difficult for me to believe he didn't know that he hit a human being.
When you watch those videos, you see the investigators. The first one is more gentle, you know, as an investigation would be. Hey, you know, how are you? Are you shaken up? Tell us what you want to tell us. And he's very willing to. In fact, the first 30 minutes of the first interview, I'm estimating there, they don't ask him any questions. He really does most of the talking. He lays things out and then offers, you know, I have this picture of my car. Here are pictures on my phone of the Lincoln dinner that I was at. Here's, you know, Senator Rounds. Here I am speaking. Here are all the people I'm with. He says he got the name of the waitress, even though he didn't know her from before, so that they could contact anyone who saw him at that dinner to confirm that he hadn't been drinking. He's just, you know, he's trying to be very forthcoming, but yet there are things about Joe Beaver's glasses and other things that would give a lot of South Dakotans pause and wonder that same question. Is he telling the truth? Is he misleading investigators about what he saw that night? Or is he an unusually inattentive driver, and is he unusually unwilling to confront what has really happened here? And I think that's one of the key questions that feeds into this idea of, do people trust him as Attorney General? The political question.
Precisely. I would say this is a minor defense of the Attorney General. Investigators often will say things in a way that maybe elides the truth or is an exaggeration to try to get somebody, you know, to fess up. Right, so we shouldn't take what investigators say as a completely accurate picture of what went on, because they're investigators and they might be trying to get Jason Raunsberg to say something. Though it seems certain that the glasses were inside the vehicle. I'm just saying, obviously, it's what we see on TV sometimes is actually true, that investigators will use certain games, and sometimes even playing a little bit free and loose with the truth to try to elicit a certain response out of someone who's under investigation. But it does seem that the evidence seems to suggest that it's hard to believe that Jason Roundsburg didn't really know what was going on, whether he did or not. Again, this is simply my take on it, which people can take, you know, for whatever it's worth, is that he seems to be fudging something. And either way, if you're going to be what is essentially the chief law enforcement official of the state of South Dakota, it's not really tenable to have someone with that kind of cloud over their heads in this position. And I think it's going to be difficult to impossible for the attorney general to sort of create an explanation that and if he could have, he would have done it already. He's given his explanation, which is, I didn't know what happened. Right. And it just seems that there is a critical mass of people who probably a majority who don't really buy the entirety of the story. And even if you did, just, you know, the killing of a person, even if it was a pure accident, which in such things happen, the questions surrounding it, maybe we just, for the integrity of the legal process, maybe we need someone as attorney general who doesn't have that cloud over their heads. And that, I think, that is what I think the governor has concluded, and what at least some members of the legislature have concluded. And I don't really have a sense of how widespread support for impeachment is amongst legislators, but as I say, there are members of both parties who support this, so it's not nothing. But I don't know that how widespread that is, and yeah. We'll find out. I suspect shortly. widespread that is.
Very briefly, because I want to make sure we talk about this other House bill before our time. But if he says, no, I haven't done anything wrong, I'm going to sit here in this office and the impeachment articles go forward, the session ends. Constitutionally, lawmakers still have time after. The 41st day rule doesn't necessarily apply to impeachment, does it? What do we have yet to understand about how this impeachment process would work? Given the length, the traditional length for doing legislative work of our session?
Well, without in having investigated it, to be honest, I would assume that the legislature can call itself into session. The governor can. We saw this with COVID, right? We can call the legislature into session to take care of important business. And if they don't get it done by the 41st day, and, you know, I guess we're in the world of impeachments these days.
It's not over.
We've seen this in Washington, D.C. That these things don't happen in a second. But even if they don't get it done by that 40th or 41st day, I would assume what they would do is either through the governor or through some process within the legislatures, call themselves into special session, and they would consider this separately and take a vote. But we'll learn within the next, say, 48 hours or so what process the people who have brought these articles aim to go through. Because one of the problems is that we're entering the time of the session where the legislature is typically very busy, and now you're throwing something very important on top of that. And I don't know if they've literally got the time to do all of this.
Yeah, certainly they would are hoping that he takes the resignation hint and moves on his way. So,
yes.
Again, much more on that story politically to sort of unpack in the days ahead. But we wanted to get to this House Bill 1247, which is an act to provide for the protection of the consciences, I should say, of medical professionals. That's what the act is officially titled. And it's several pages. And in 30 seconds, John Schaff, sum it up for us, because this is about the fundamental constitutional right of a conscience.
Yeah, well, you have two things.
Did the founders say we had a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of a conscience?
Conscience language is used all the time in the era of the founding related to religious conscience, and it is a very standard language. You can find this, for example, in many writings by James Madison. And so I think what's going on in this bill, depending on whether you're for it or against it, though so far it seems to have a fair amount of support, do you look at this as a sword that can be used by people attack certain things that they don't want to have to do, and some people would label it as discriminatory, or is it a shield to protect people, especially people in the medical profession, who might have conscientious objections to certain procedures. It's you're not under this bill able to deny treatment to a person, but you might be able to object to certain procedures that you think violate your conscience, religious, moral, or otherwise. And so where you fall on that depends on how you see that. But there is a long tradition in American history of using the law to protect people's consciences. So you're right. It is consciousness.
You're Jiminy Cricket. All
yes.
Right?
So, yes, exactly.
And so, of course, the concern is, and we're just going to wrap up here, but, you know, are women going to have to go to a different doctor to find the one that will give them birth control? Are transgender people going to have to go to a different doctor to find one that thinks it's okay to treat a transgender person?
That is the conflict of yeah. Mm-hmm. which is more fundamental to the American system, the right to the medical procedures you're talking about, or the right to someone's religious conscience not being violated under compulsion of law, or from corporate compulsions as well, which is often the case.
All that happening in your state legislature. John Schaff, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Highs will top out in the upper 30s in the west today with a chance of some isolated snow showers. Parts of the Black Hills could see 1 to 2 inches of snow accumulation this afternoon. That weather won't be a factor, however, if you're planning to enjoy the Black Hills Film Festival. It's virtual and it's online this year. Check out today's schedule by going to blackhillsfilmfestival.org. Sun and highs in the lower 40s in the east present a nice opportunity to enjoy All Done, the Harvey Dunn collection. It's part of the 50th anniversary of the opening of the South Dakota Art Museum in Brookings. Dunn attended South Dakota Agricultural College, which is now SDSU. In Sioux Falls, Isolation is a collaborative installation that contemplates notions of privacy, isolation, and shelter. Throughout the confusing and chaotic time of COVID-19, there have undoubtedly been moments of fear and hopelessness in all of us. The worst pain is often felt by those already vulnerable to poverty, dislocation, and hunger. The Visual Arts Center is hosting the Isolation installation through Friday. More clouds and sun in the northeast with highs right around 40 today. In honor of National Youth Art Month, the PC Wine Gallery in Aberdeen presents the Groton Area High School Art Department. It's taught by Miss Janine Harry. Now keep in mind that this exhibit also ends Friday, when temperatures should pick up just a little with highs into the lower 40s and lower 50s. Up next, taxes and insects. Maybe neither one is as devastating as you think. We'll talk about how the smallest of changes can help make tax time and agriculture more regenerative. You are on listener-supported SDPB Radio. You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In a few minutes, we're going to reconsider the humble insect and how the smallest of changes can transform thousands of acres. But first, we reconsider something equally maligned as the common bug: taxes. Rick Kaler is founder of the Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. He's an international leader in the field of financial therapy, one of our favorite guests. We talk with him via Zoom for a little tax time financial therapy to have some fun with a not so fun annual task.
It really brings out a lot of the emotion is when people think of taxes. You know, we have found that the average person has 50 to 200 money scripts operating 24/7. A lot of times we're unaware of those or subconscious. When we work with folks, a large number of those money scripts or a fraction can be due to taxes.
All right, let's go through some of these one by one. And the first one I'm sure you remember or have learned by now is one of my favorites, which is, because it hits close to home, which is money avoidance.
Yeah. Absolutely. A money avoider just in review, believes that money's bad. It's anxiety producing for them. Oftentimes the money scripts that rich people are greedy. I find the main emotion around that can be fear. You know, a lot of avoiders believe that they don't deserve money. I was talking with one of my associates today, and he said, oh yeah, I once had a client that just decided the way they were going to handle their taxes is not pay them at all. And this was a client that owed millions of dollars and would say, yeah, I looked at that file and I just put it down. And I didn't look at it until next year. That's pretty severe avoidance when you just don't even pay or file. There's a lot of messages that go with that. Like, I'm incompetent. I don't understand this. I don't enjoy it. I don't want to deal with it. I don't even want to look at it. And a lot of that can be driven by fear and messages around that.
Here's the way that I have dealt with that regarding taxes. And that is, I found a tax preparer who is a really nice woman who I like to go see once a year. And so then I don't think about it being taxes. I think now I get to go see her. Won't that be nice? And then, and then I will show up. Are there other ways for avoiders to kind of confront some of those beliefs or feelings so that they can move forward with the work that really does need to be done?
Yeah, what you've come up with is a really great way for an avoider to handle. Let somebody that loves to do it, do it. A lot of it can be just looking at, what am I afraid of? What is it that money represents to me? Where did that start? Where did that come from? Just starting to try and understand the root of the message and the emotions behind it can start some movement to putting in a different behavior in place. And maybe that's gathering all the receipts monthly or doing some things that make it easier when tax time comes around.
All right. How about for people who have money status as their primary belief?
Yeah, these are folks that equate their net worth with their self-worth. So they can believe that people aren't only as successful as the money they earn. And their main emotions can be pride and insecurity. When they think about taxes, they can have thoughts that come up. They can be very proud about the taxes they pay. They can also feel really prideful that they can hire the best professionals and pay less in taxes, kind of like another status type of a thing. They can also take on the idea of, let me tell you all the ways that I avoid taxes.
People who worship money a little bit, how is that different?
Yeah, so they believe that things would always be better if I had a little bit more money, or that money is going to make me happier, or money will solve all of my problems. I think their main emotion is anger. And at tax time, they do not really appreciate the government taking away their money. And here is a really curious one. This particular type can want to avoid paying taxes at all costs. In other words, they are willing to have less wealth in order not to pay taxes.
Oh.
And you don't have to have a lot of money to be in this category. We see clients that are upset they don't have a mortgage payment anymore. Write-offs are good, right? So let me go spend a dollar so I can write off and save 10% of it, 20% of it in taxes. That makes no sense. You're still out the other 80 cents. But it makes sense when the script is paying taxes are bad and I will go to any extreme not to pay taxes. That money script gets in the way of doing financial planning all the time.
Money vigilance. Tell me about that. These are the people who are ready for tax season.
Oh, yeah. They're the folks that save. They save their receipts. They know what exactly is happening. Their main emotion is anxiety. And their thoughts are like just anxiety around doing the taxes right, filling it out, getting it in on time, probably early. Sometimes it makes lots of sense to extend, right? You can extend your paying your taxes till October 15th. And there's some evidence that would suggest that your audit chances are lower if you file on October 15th. A money vigilant can hardly sit with that thought because they want to get it done. They want to get it over with. They want it to be correct. So they triple check everything. They often do their own taxes, which can actually result in them paying more in tax because they can be very secretive around letting anybody know what they make and what they're worth. So, and they also have scripts like tax preparers cost so much money. I'll just save that money.
Mm-hmm. Right? Sure. Are there, you know, accountants or CPAs who are interested in financial therapy as well?
I do believe that there's some financial therapists that have been CPAs, but I don't know of a practicing CPA who's also trained in financial therapy or is a financial therapist as such. I'm sure it's not going to be too long. Someday you may go into your CPA and that they'll have the financial therapy division.
I'm sure I'm not the only person who has ever been stressed out or shed a tear or gotten an argument over taxes. It's a difficult time of year. So like now I know that I have a name for something. How do I sort of process feeling some of those feelings?
Yeah, there's a number of ways of processing. It's just huge to be able to first name the feeling that you're feeling, whether it's anger or fear or anxiety. And then some things that can work is like journaling, like what's coming up around this? What to try and get to those are original thoughts that they came, where they came from. Maybe they've come from family. For a lot of us, getting to the emotion, separating the emotion from the reaction, like, why is it so important for me to pay no tax? What is that message? What is the feeling behind the message, which is so important to get to? And of course, if there's a financial therapist on your block, it's a good person to go try and process this with.
And now, further thoughts on how a slight change in perspective might lead to sweeping transformation. A South Dakota State University graduate student is looking into insect-friendly field management practices that can save farmers money. SDPB's Laura Rohde has this story.
Instead of eliminating insects from crop acres, Alex Michaels is researching farm practices that encourage them.
So for every 1,700 insect species, there's only one pest species. You know, insects get a bad rap. You see a bad insect out there, you think you got to spray right away, but you can kill all those other 1,700 good and beneficial insects as well.
When Michaels refers to good insects, she's talking about beneficial insects that work to pollinate plants or break down manure or eat weed seeds or aerate the soil or eat insects that cause harm to crops like corn, soybeans, sunflowers, or wheat. A recent field study this South Dakota State University graduate student conducted looked at the effectiveness of predator insects.
And so I did an experiment on some fields where I put a caterpillar larva out on a field and I pinned it to the ground so it couldn't move. And then I left it out there for an hour. I came back after an hour, checked to see if the caterpillar was dead or alive, if it was eaten. And what I found was, I think I put 1,000 caterpillars out there and a third of them were gone within 1 hour. They were eaten by insects.
Alex Michaels' research also looks at regenerative farm practices like no-till and cover crops that are known to entice beneficial insects like those predator insects that ate the caterpillars. She then evaluates how much money farmers save through ecosystem services provided by beneficial insects. For example, when predator insects take care of a pest, then farmers don't need to buy insecticide. Michael's hope is that by demonstrating the cost savings connected to certain farming practices, more farmers will be motivated to implement practices that are not only friendly to beneficial insects, but also reduce the need to apply pesticides.
I think farmers have a big opportunity to, they have so much land. They can impact so many acres by just small changes.
Michael's research is funded through a grant with the Ecdysis Foundation. The data will be compiled and published when her thesis is complete early summer 21. If you're wondering why beneficial insects prefer fields that have not been tilled or ones that have a diverse mix of plant species planted on them, Huron farmer Jeff Hemingway explains it this way.
They need water and food and shade, and they're not going to go very out, far out in that field because it's hot and dry and really just kind of like a desert environment out in that field. But if you get into a no-till field and been doing it for a long period of time, that whole environment changes. And all of a sudden you end up with all this residue and mulch on the across the top of the field. And now those ants go all the way across the field. Well, ants are one of those predatory insects that most people don't think about, that they're a major predator out in our environment.
Hemingway hasn't tilled his fields for more than 20 years. And a few years back, he experienced something similar to what Alex Michaels saw in her caterpillar research.
Well, a flight of cutworms coming in, and not to explain it in great detail, but you can actually see that their eggs are really bright orange and they're laid on the residue on the field. And because I've been in diverse rotation that's been no-till for a long period of time, I've got a lot of beneficial insects across the field. I just wanted to see if they were going to be a pest in the field. So I went and flagged that area out so I could tell where it was and kept scouting it and looking at those plants in that area, et cetera. And, you know, I can tell you bottom line, what happened? Nothing. Well, nothing happened because your insect populations that are beneficial that are present in the field actually killed that pest. In other words, ate those eggs, et cetera, before they became a pest within the field.
And any time his management practices entice nature to take care of a problem for him, Hemingway says it's a win-win.
Well, you know, as a farmer, I think that one of the first things you want to do is, of course, make money like anybody else. But at the same time, there's a stewardship. In other words, there's a responsibility for taking care of the environment that is the field that you have.
Another reason Hemingway is slowed to use pesticide is in addition to crops, he is also a beekeeper. He got into bees after hearing a speaker share how the pollinator insect could boost soybean yields.
If you have a hive of bees near a bean field, you could experience as much as a 4 bushel per acre yield increase.
At the current market price of about $13.70 per bushel, an additional 4 bushels per acre increase can amount to quite a bit at harvest. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.
You can find all our stories, small and large, on our website, sdpb.org/news. Well, that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Here's a few other things that might be of use. You can find our videos on our YouTube channel. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Instagram, SDPB in the moment. On Twitter, I'm @MomentSDPB. You can also send us your stories and ideas. InTheMoment@sdpb.org. is our email. For Steve Swemke, Josh Heyer, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.